Hi, this is Mo.
And this is Sarah, and you're listening to the podcast Bird Shit.
We started this podcast to share our love of birding with other enthusiastic birders in the world.
Welcome to our podcast. It is about birds. Is that what we say every time?
That's what we say every time for everybody who forgets in a 2-week time period that they're into birds.
Well, now that we've done our normal, very normal intro, Mo, we have a new interview we're doing today.
Yeah, I know. Talking to just two of us wasn't enough for us, so we had to bring in a third person to talk to.
That's all of our relationship throughout time. There's always been a third person.
Yeah, the unspoken third person in our lives, like our mutual invisible friend that we brought into our two-person friendship.
We just pretend there's someone who sits and edits the podcast and is working on the sound while we're recording. They're not really here. Mo does it all. We are going to be interviewing Alyssa De Rebeyes, who we met in Montreal.
This is a fun story for the birding world, but we met Alyssa because on a road trip through Canada to drive me to Maine to live here now, Sarah came with me and we met Andreas in Toronto, which was fun. And we met Alyssa in Montreal. She took us on a incredible birding adventure, one that we will never forget, at the Technopark Montreal, in which we sort of ended up trying to find this trail and we couldn't really find the trail. So we kind of bushwhacked our way through some really pointy cattails, and poor Sarah was wearing shorts. Your legs got destroyed.
I swear to God, I thought I had like a massive infection because one of the like wounds just would not heal. And I would like to say we were bushwhacking with our arms substituting as like machetes. We had no form of cutting down the cattails. We were just like,
it was an arm shetty.
Yeah, it was an arm shetty movement.
But Alyssa was great. And then we ended up going out with her and her boyfriend, Jacques, afterwards. And then they took us to brunch the next day, which was so good. So, like, we just had a great time with Alyssa. She's an absolute joy. And she's super into birds. She's so smart. She taught us so much about birds on that walk with her, even though we only saw, like, 10 different species. I mean, I feel like I learned so much just from walking with her.
I feel like instantly too, I knew that I was the grasshopper because like she would be like, what's that bird call? And I would be like, oh, teacher, me, let me answer.
I know, it's like, oh, this is just evidence of how little we know about birds, but also cool that, you know, typical of the birding world, everyone's there to teach and educate and help other people out.
Yeah.
It's a big old kumbaya kind of birdie situation.
I really liked where you went with that. That was great.
Off the deep end.
Anyways, we'll give a little background about Alyssa before she joins us. So Alyssa De Rebeyes grew up in Minneapolis, where she was always fascinated by nature. When she was 5 years old, a migrating American Red Start solidified her passion for birds. Alyssa always knew she was pursue a naturalist career. And in 2013, she got her bachelor's in wildlife ecology from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And then during her time as an undergrad, she worked a lot with grassland raptors and the greater prairie chicken, which I'm sure we'll talk about. She then went on to receive the Aldo Leopold Award for undergraduates by the Wisconsin State Chapter of Wildlife Society, which recognizes students who show promise in the field of wildlife conservation. She's traveled and worked all over, including Alaska, the Upper Midwest, Arkansas, and Belize. She finally went back to the University of Arkansas, where she got her master's degree on non-breeding birds in remnant and restored tallgrass prairies. And she completed her thesis in July, which is awesome.
Whoop, whoop.
So as we said, she resides in Montreal right now with her partner, Jacques, where she's trying to find her way into a job as a naturalist or biologist. And since she's got a little free time, Alyssa also enjoys dabbling in watercolor, nature photography, cooking, dancing, specifically twerking, and more. We're super excited to talk to her today about her grassland bird conservation and some of the other things she's obviously very accomplished in her field of work.
This whole list of things just made me realize, like, my birding accolades was like, saw a bird 2 years ago, thought it was cool, thought that was enough qualifications to launch a podcast.
Dude, I think we had a little more free time on our hands too, where we were like, yeah, let's try doing something new.
I think my favorite part was when we were interviewing Andreas. He said something like, you guys should start a snake podcast. And we're like, oh, we don't know anything about snakes. And he's like, do we know anything about birds? And I just like come back to that moment in my mind sometimes and be like, oh yeah, like, thanks, dude.
That was such a good own. But I think it's good because now we're going to learn things along with our listeners so we don't come off as like know-it-all jerks. Just as Mo mentioned, it's just a big old kumbaya party.
All right. Well, Alyssa, thanks for joining us on the podcast. We're so excited to have you here.
Ooh, thanks for having me. This is really exciting.
Yeah. We're all in the north part of the hemisphere, really.
I mean, in the same time zone, too. That's pretty impressive.
Wow. Yeah. From Maine to Michigan, all in the same time zone.
Yeah.
Montreal included. Well, anyway, we're really excited to have you here. You were such an excellent host to us, and we were in Montreal. You took us on some birding adventures. We almost saw a great bittern. Definitely had a good time finding it, at least. And also, you found us some great brunch places, which was very welcome.
Very important. And can I just say the first fully unisex bathroom I've ever been in?
Really? Wow. That is pretty cool, actually.
The one at the bar where I was like, I could just walk in and a guy peeing at a urinal, which I don't care. But at first I was like very confused because I was like,
Oh, Sarah, that wasn't a unisex bathroom. I forgot to tell you. JK, JK. Made a bathroom joke. Won't be the first one, probably. So yeah, you obviously have a lot of things that you're very good at from brunch to birds. And we're going to focus on the bird part, but if you want to sneak in some brunch, like, you just go for it. Going back, all the way back, what was it that first got you into birding?
It was a combination of things, and I was just thinking about it today. It was really the perfect storm, so to speak. I had, first and foremost, I had a mother who came from kind of a naturalist background. She had a garden that she tended to, and I would help her with that. She put up bird feeders, so I would see chickadees and nuthatches coming to that. And she bought field guides, and she bought me field guides. And the story goes that I learned to read on field guides. Those are my children's books. So I owe a lot of that to her, but also we were in an environment where I had pretty easy access to nature. I was in the suburbs. There were a couple ponds nearby that I would go and explore either on my own or with my sisters. In our backyard, we have huge oak trees, like these great oak trees. And it was actually really nice in migration because we get birds coming through and tanagers and vireos and warblers. And it was a warbler that really like solidified my love for bird watching. And I was 5 years old, and you might wonder, how do you know? I actually have the exact date because I wrote it down. I had a little field journal at the time. I was 5 years old, and my mom was looking at some other bird, and I was in our yard, and it was this, I remember it very well. It was this beautiful sunny day. I was under one of our oak trees, and on the ground, not 5 feet from me, on the ground hopping around was this American red star. And if you don't know what that looks like, it's this fantastic Halloween-y type warbler. It's black and orange and very flashy, very active. And I just, like, I really couldn't believe that it was right there at my feet. You know, that left a huge impression on me. And in my journal, I talked about it and I said it was a migrating, which is spelled, I guess in my five-year-old head, it's like migerating. So,
I mean, I didn't even know what that word was when I was five. So
I like did my best guess. My mom could have corrected it, but I suppose she wanted me to learn on my own time. So, and I was into other stuff too. We raised monarch caterpillars. I remember when I was a kid, I would go to the pond and catch pond animals, little pond critters like water scorpions and
tadpoles.
Yes, tadpoles. That was like always the end goal, but sometimes I couldn't find them. From a young age, I knew that this would follow me for the rest of my life, and I would do something with it career-wise, which I'm still trying to figure out, but you know, it'll happen, I think, in due time.
So you mentioned the American red star. I think you mentioned that's your spark bird, and you actually have something to honor that?
I do. Yes, sir. I do have something to honor that. In my first tattoo ever, I have on my right ankle, on the inside of it, is a male American red star. And I think it's fitting that it's on my foot, not like on my arm, because when I saw my lifer, it was on the ground. So probably not too far from my right foot. So it was fitting. And I've been getting more tattoos now as I'm getting older. That was like my first one, and I've gotten a couple more. One isn't a bird, but the other one is the head of a great gray owl, because I feel such a deep connection with them. They're just such a, like, time stands still when you're looking at one, and it's just this very, it's almost like spiritual in a way, this very kind of weird aura, like comforting and soothing aura I get from seeing one. And I've had the fortune of observing quite a few great gray owls in my day. I am all for bird tattoos. They even have a competition, if you guys are aware of the biggest week in American birding. It's every May in Ohio. I haven't been, but I know a lot of people who go. And one of the competitions now is for the best bird tattoo.
You got to enter, man.
I might enter too.
You guys should go and you should totally do that. That'd be awesome. What was your tattoo again?
It's a barn owl on my back.
Yes. Oh, yes. Dude, that's a good one. Owls are great.
I know. I think I might add to it too. I want like a Japanese raven really bad. The jungle crow.
Oh,
they're okay. Huge and like so scary. And they have warnings about them all over the place because they're like giant. And I really want one.
Okay. I know you're into the scary stuff. You told me about the guy who sold you a painting and there was some red in the painting. It was a red-tailed hawk.
Yeah, it's in my office right now. Yeah, it's two falcons fighting over a rat and it has this blood in it.
And it has the artist's blood. So you are into the scary stuff.
Yeah, but I also have a soft side. Let's not forget. Let's not forget, guys.
I'll make you a heart with blood.
Yay!
There we go. There's your soft side. Always has to have blood, though.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to have the blood. Otherwise, Sarah's not into it. All of the art in Sarah's house has blood. I don't know if she told you that.
Well, except the one I made. I painted her a king vulture and didn't do blood for that one.
Oh, I assume the orange and red in it was blood. It's coming down now. It's camping.
Yeah, okay, I'm so sorry. I don't even know how to make orange with blood, so I guess I can mix some white in there, some white paint.
That's a good point. Yeah, how do you make orange with blood?
I don't know. I think we're going to have to do some really weird art classes, guys.
Okay, so you talked a little bit about the Red Start, got you into birding, and now you've grown up and you've seen more birds. I know that you did do your master's down in Georgia studying birds. Was there a particular population of birds that you were interested in, or like how you ended up focusing your research on what you ended up focusing on? Like kind of maybe walk us through that a little bit.
You know, if you had told me that I would be researching grassland birds at a young age, I would be really confused because where I grew up, I actually like didn't see a prairie for the first time until later in high school when I got really into birding. And I always thought grassland birds are cool, but like didn't feel a close connection with them just because I didn't grow up with it. And I thought I'd be working with forest birds, maybe with warblers like my spark bird. I remember people having jobs in all these crazy places like Alaska and out west where there are mountains. And so I was like, yeah, I'm going to do something with birds on a mountain. I didn't think much about grassland birds until right after my graduation. I started a job in Wisconsin. It's kind of a long story, but basically I had envisioned myself having a much more exciting job in a different place and all my plans fell through. I was kind of heartbroken. And then this last minute opportunity came up with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Just doing grassland bird surveys, their point counts, you stand in one spot for 5 to 10 minutes and you count all these grassland birds that are within a certain radius of you. So it didn't seem very exciting to me. And it was in an area I'd already been to before. So I was kind of like meh about it. I had talked to my boss about it one day. His name's David Sample, by the way. He still works Wisconsin DNR and he is awesome. He's one of my favorite mentors of all time. So I hope he hears this. But one day I asked him like, Dave, like who cares about grassland birds? Like they're not cool. Like warblers. And I mean, they're all these kind of like tan and brown colors. Like who cares? And he's like, well, actually, they've been declining pretty precipitously and more than any other terrestrial bird group. And it turns out that's true. And if you look at there's a graph that the Breeding Bird Survey folks put together, and you look at forest birds, wetland birds, aridland birds, and grassland birds, and of those groups, the grassland birds are by far declining the most. So they actually, of any bird group in general, I would say that they need our help the most. And at that point I was like, oh, okay. So I'm doing some good wholesome work.
So basically you were interested because they were declining, or what, like you wanted to just understand that and like solve that problem a little bit more?
Basically. Yeah. I felt bad that humans have really contributed so much to their decline. And this is true for pretty much most wildlife globally, but if you look at the number one threat to wildlife on a global scale, a lot of people might think, oh, it's pollution or oh, it's climate change. But even more than that, it's just straight up habitat loss. Like we are, we're building over their habitats, and grasslands are a great thing to build over. They have something called mollisol in their soil, and it's I'm not a soil scientist, so I'll do my best to explain
that. I mean, we won't be able to correct you.
Okay. Well, there we go. So I'm a soil scientist right now. Jokes on you. But it makes the soil really rich and fertile, which is great for growing crops on it or maybe having some cows grazing on it. So that's what most of our grasslands have been converted to. Do you want to guess how much of it exists since the pre-settlement era on this continent? What percentage do you think remains?
10.
I was going to say 5.
Less than 5.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
It's less than 3%. And in my home state of Minnesota, it's less than 1%.
How much of it is converted for commercial agriculture? Like, is that the biggest reason?
It would probably depend on where you are. Like, I know in Iowa, they have a lot of cornfields. And further west, like in typical like rangeland country, like the northern Great Plains, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, out there, I think it might be more pastures. So it kind of depends on where you are. In Northwest Arkansas, where I did my research, it was probably more pastures, I would say.
So in your research, what kinds of threats did you find were the most common to grassland birds, like overall?
I had 5, I guess, technically 5 field sites. One of them appeared to be the size of the patch because like grassland birds are known to be area sensitive, which means that they require like a certain size for their territory. And I think this is more evident in prairie birds just because they don't have that vertical structure that they can expand their territory into. So it's completely horizontal. If there's a grassland and it's under a certain size, either they'll be less dense or they just won't occur there. It won't be big enough for them. So we did find that out. Well, actually really just one in the non-breeding season, which was sedge runs. So they were really not as dense in the smaller sites, in my smaller field sites, but they were much more in the bigger ones. Dick thistle, which I spent a lot of time studying for my master's research, that was also one in the breeding season that appears to be area sensitive. But what my research showed is that the further away you got from a woodland edge, the more that the detection rate increased for dick thistle and sedge run.
So I know that you initially like didn't want to work with grassland birds when you first started, but like, do they have a soft spot in your heart now that you've been working with them?
Yes. Oh, they definitely do. Yeah. One of my next tattoos, I would like to be a sedge run. Because they are the darnest, cutest little fluffy meatballs on legs.
Oh,
it's so true. You look up pictures of them. But yeah, they're pretty neat. And what's cool too, like you might look at it and, well, the size, like the proportions and sizes are both cute, but the plumage, like the feather patterns and all that and the colors aren't particularly exciting to like someone who's new to bird watching maybe, but what they lack in color, they make up for in charm. And this is a bird of like, you'll be walking around and you'll hear it. And it's like coming in closer and closer. And it's like sneaking through the dead grass. And like, it'll almost be at your feet. They're so curious. But like the way they move, they're just like kind of stalking you.
You know what that reminds me of? In Jurassic Park, you remember those really tiny ones that looked like raptors that were like always following people around? Yep, that's what that reminds me of.
They probably were velociraptors like millions of years ago, actually, now that you mention it.
So if these animals hold a special place in your heart, and obviously we care about all birds, what conservation efforts can we focus on to help grassland birds?
There are a few things that we can do. So what my research looked at, and this is one way we can help, but supporting any organization that tries to restore and connect parcels of remaining grassland, because that's going to be really important. And I was talking about these small sizes, it's just not doing it for them. So we need to be buying adjacent properties and expanding the size, or better yet, connecting them to other protected grasslands nearby. The good news is in my research, I was comparing nesting success between remnant prairies, which are prairies that have been relatively untouched by human, and restored prairies, relatively like newly created by human. They're planting stuff, they're removing non-native invasive species. And this is on land that maybe it was tilled or it was used for row crop or was intensively used by cattle for grazing. People are taking these lands and trying to convert them back into prairies. And now the good news is in my research, I was comparing the nesting success between remnant and restored prairies, and there doesn't appear to be a difference at that scale. So that means that we could be making new prairies, and it could be good enough, at least for nesting grassland birds. So like I know the Nature Conservancy, they like to purchase land. There might be programs at the state level organizations that you can enroll your your property, if you have it in like a conservation easement, maybe you agree to do some kind of management to, in this case, make it a prairie, and that you promise to never develop it. There's a lot of programs for that kind of stuff. So if someone out there has property in mind for something like that, they have resources. You can get recognized for it. You can get something saying, yeah, my property is wildlife friendly. I think that's the National Wildlife Federation that does that, but also probably some state agencies too. So you deserve recognition if you decide to protect your land, because that is probably the single most important thing anyone can do.
Not necessarily knowing the difference that much between grasslands and prairies, but can those areas, if they are conserved, can they still be used for humans? Like, can you still create trails through them? Or like, will that disturb the birds too much? Like, they are pretty much off limits to everything except the animals that need to occupy them.
So two things. You had mentioned the difference between grassland and prairies. To my knowledge, they're interchangeable. I guess if you want to sound like more technical, the specific habitat I worked in was tall grass prairie, which is a kind of grassland. But secondly, you know, the sites I worked in, there were trails, and I didn't see anything indicating that that negatively affected dick thistles. I only looked at nesting dick thistles, and dick thistles, by the way, are supposedly related to like cardinals and indigo buntings and stuff, but they look more like a meadowlark. So think of that kind of bird, but more like a meadowlark, I guess.
Turns out it's really hard to search for dick thistle because the first four letters just really screw up the search.
It's true. You want to also guess what the four-letter code for dick thistle is?
Is it just dick?
It's dick.
Yes.
So in my notebook, I'd be writing like, check dick nest number 34 today. Dick 34 for short. So I was dealing with a lot of dick. 114 dicks.
Wow.
Sarah and I definitely went to some dick nests in college. Oh, yeah. I can tell you that.
Oh, really? Okay. Did you look at the success of these dick nests?
I personally experienced the success.
Oh, okay. So they were successful. That's awesome. All right. You should publish a paper on that.
Oh my God.
It would never get published, but I'll try.
Yeah. Or maybe make up your own journal if no other journal is going to publish it for you.
Yeah, that's true. We made our own podcast.
I mean, this is useful information for future people that want to explore dick nests, you know?
Yeah.
People deserve to be aware. Information is good.
All right. Sorry. I just had to like point that out about the dick thistle. I was like, oh my God, this is not going to be a nice Google search.
Yeah, people always like me to be like, wait, what's the name of your study bird again? They got the name because they call it a mnemonic, I believe. And that's where you maybe you've heard of that. It's like where you come up with, chickadee is a great example. It's because they sound like chickadee, dee, 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 chickadee, dee. And there's a lot of many other species. And dick thistle is one of them. And so their song is dick, dick, sis-sissle. You can use your imagination a little, but it's there.
It's like constellations for me. It's like I look up at the sky. I was like, I guess that's a lion or a
yeah,
bear.
I suppose you could say that's a belt.
Yeah, right? Is that a belt?
I'm always for making up new constellations, but like people making up their own. But now we were talking about dick thistles and trails, but a lot of my dick thistles actually nested right next to trails. At least for them, they don't care. There was a paper published, though, back, I want to say, in the mid-2000s, and there are some more sensitive species. I think one of the examples was henseless sparrows, and they did not like being by trails. So in that context, like if you want to protect a prairie, but you also want people being able to recreate in it, which I think is totally fine, especially if that improves our appreciation and like determination to protect sites like this, that's fine to put trails in there, but maybe I wouldn't do it to every single part. So leave some places totally undisturbed for species like the henseless sparrow, and then, you know, and dick thistles were nest wherever the hell they feel like they want to. Yeah.
Wherever they want to lay their dick.
Wherever they want to lay their dick down, yeah.
I was more just curious because I know like some areas when you conserve them, it's hard to validate it or justify it if it's like completely off limits to humans, essentially, let's be real. But it's good to know that that seems like it could be a benefit in terms of why you should conserve them is you're absolutely right. Like it could improve appreciation and like that it becomes a public space for all while still offering this benefit to birds. Like that's a triple win right there.
It is. And another great thing about these prairies too, one reason why folks really love going out there is because there's a pretty fantastic flower show there. And it goes from like May through August, I would say. And depending on what time you're there, you're going to be seeing different flowers. But I'm happy to share some pictures with you. But I mean, there were times where I had to be careful where I was stepping or else I'd be stepping on a flower. And And yeah, so that's great. And with the flowers, of course, you get bees and weird, interesting little wasps. And I would go out there every day and see a bug I had never seen before. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. Like, this creature I had absolutely no awareness of until this very moment in time. It's like, it has its own ecology. And it's probably been around for millennia.
I love bugs.
They're so cool,
bugs
right?
Bugs are so cool.
What's your favorite?
I would have to say probably dung beetles. Like, I know it's really cliche, but they're just so cool. And they serve such a good purpose in ecology. I don't know. I love dung beetles. And then anything that is shiny. If it is a shiny bug, I'm like a five-year-old. I'm like, ooh, it's shiny. We focused a lot like on a very specific population, but kind of expanding out from that, you took Mo and I on a great birding tour guide, and it was wonderful, and I felt like we learned a lot. So what tips do you have for birders when they're looking for birds, especially for like new people like us?
One of my favorite things to tell folks is to be aware, and this might sound like, well, duh, if you're bird watching, you gotta be aware. But when I say aware, I mean not only visually, like looking for birds, but also listening to birds and listening, you know, auditorially. A lot of these birds you're not going to see until you hear them, and then you pinpoint where they are. And I've done surveys in forested environments, and I would estimate that about 80% of all the birds that I had on them were heard only. So I knew they were there, you know, winter wren or blackburnian warbler, all these really cool birds. I knew they were there, but I didn't see them. I started really getting into bird watching in high school, and I would listen to the bird calls. I knew, you know, so I would recognize it when I was outside birding. And my lifer, Scarlet Tanager, that's exactly what happened. I heard it calling, and I'm like, I've listened to that online. I know that's a Scarlet Tanager's chick bird call note. And sure enough, like a few moments later, I saw it up in the tree. So it was really cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah, you guys should definitely try that. A good one to do, I think, is Indigo Bunting. It's a pretty fun, distinctive song you can listen to. And then another would be figure out where are the good bird watching places. Where are people seeing a lot of like different species and ones that you definitely haven't seen before? Those are good places to check out. And a really good resource for that is eBird. And you can look on there and it'll tell you the hotspots. It'll tell you who's seen what.
We both use eBird, but I've only recently gotten into like the hotspot thing. And it makes sense because I live really close to the ocean. But everyone I talk to here in Maine that I tell them I'm into birding, they're like, oh, you got to go to Evergreen Cemetery. And I'm like, what is Evergreen Cemetery? And it turns out it's like, it's inland. And so any birds that don't like the coast essentially are going like a little more inland. And it's just this huge expansive cemetery. It's got like some marshlands. I mean, it's a cemetery. So it's like this huge space. And I never really would have thought that that would be a good spot just because of where I live, but it's only like, you know, 15 minute drive away. And I can get like a ton of different birds. I went there a few weeks ago and I saw, I want to say red-bellied woodpecker. Is that right? The ones that have like the bright red. It's like, it's a bad name for the birds.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And I was like, I know what that is because it always shows up in eBird as this bird that I'm supposed to be seeing, but I never have seen it. And so it was like a lifer for me. And I was like, who would have thought like end of October in Maine that I would see that bird?
Yeah. And in a cemetery, no less. Actually, I know a lot of cemeteries are super popular because they are protected areas. And a lot of them have, for whatever reason, they have evergreens, hence that was the name of your cemetery. And that can be excellent for things like crossbills and owls and other coveted birds like in the winter. So cemeteries, that's one of those places where people like you wouldn't know that unless you talk to people who've been birding for years or if you go on eBird. Another really weird place that people don't think about too much is wastewater treatment plants. Depending on how it's managed, it can be really good.
My dad used to work in wastewater treatment, so yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, so would you ever go there, and did you ever see birds there?
Oh, yeah. When I was younger, yep. We went with them a couple of times, and yeah, it's got a lot of nature around it.
Yeah, it's pretty insane because people are like, oh, that's a nasty, smelly place. Like, why would I go birding there? But yeah, but if there's water, there can be ducks, shorebirds. It's really good for that kind of stuff. Airports, too, is another one. People go there all the time for snowy owls and other kind of open ground birds, snow buntings.
These are like all places I would never tell someone to go because you're like, oh, yeah, you want to go bird watching with me in a cemetery or a wastewater treatment plant or a really noisy airport? I feel like someone would be like, no, you're going to murder me. We are not really bird watching.
Yeah. Like, no thanks, weirdo.
One thing I know you mentioned earlier is like all of these places, like you said, are not typical things that I would look for in places to find birds, but you are also really into nesting. You know, I have all these great tips to find birds, but what about finding nests?
I really love it, and I've gotten more and more in love with it as I've gotten older, and especially with my master's research, I had to find, that was my entire first chapter, was finding as many Dick Sisal nests as I could. The reason why I love it is because it's a really fun and rewarding challenge. Because after a while, you know, you figure out the birds in your area and you see them a lot, and maybe you're looking for, you know, something to spice up your birding life. What are you going to do? You can look for bird nests. Now, I will, before I get into how to look for bird nests, this can be a touchy subject because you do want to be respectful of the birds. If you do find a nest, you want to spend absolute minimum amount of time there as possible. You're not spending minutes and minutes there. It should be like you look at it for maybe 10 seconds and then you get out of there. And ideally, you don't go back and disturb it again because it's a very stressful situation. So, you know, so keeping that in mind, it's still really fun to find nests. I actually have a booklet. Well, it's like a photo journal, but I've compiled all the bird nest species that I've photographed.
Whoa!
Yeah, it's really cool. And I've written little naturalist notes. It just kind of happened this way. I've had jobs where I have to find nests. And then for my research, I had to find them. So it's just a passion that has grown and grown. So the reason why it's a challenge is because these birds don't want you to find their nests. They want to try to make it as sneaky as possible, with a few exceptions. I mean, you've seen a big bald eagle nest up in a tree before, or you've seen like a robin or a barn swallow nesting under the eave of your house. So some of those, the birds don't really give a fuck about where they put it, but a lot of them want to be really sneaky. And I can definitely say it with the Dick Sisals. Some of them are relatively easy, but a lot of them were like, you had to be looking so hard. And actually at one point, my advisor was helping me and he's like, yeah, I keep seeing this bird. I know she has a nest right here, but I can't find it. So I'm like, okay, let me come out and help you. And we're looking around. He's like, yeah, it's like right in here somewhere. And I look down at his feet and I'm like, dude, your foot is literally right next to the nest. But he couldn't find it because it was so well hidden. But I was at the right angle. I happened to see it. There's like three main things I would tell people to look for. One is nest building. So if a bird has like grass or sticks or leaves or something in its bill that like, you know, it's not going to be eating, it's like some non-living material, that means that he or she is building a nest. And you can kind of go and watch, you know, see where do they go to with that nest material. Do they keep going to this one spot and then flying out with nothing in their bill? And if so, it's probably where the nest is. You do want to be careful at that stage because they can abandon it if you're lingering around too much, because at that point they haven't invested that much time, effort, energy. So, you know, if they're like, oh, there's a predator around, maybe this isn't a good spot for my nest after all. You can do it in a way that's not too disturbing to the birds. The second way would be, I'm going ways that like that are easiest to more difficult, I would say. So the second one would be a bird carrying food or a fecal sac. So normally when a bird catches something like a bug, it wants to eat it right away if it's for the adult bird. So you're not going to be seeing it flying around with this bug, because why wouldn't it just eat it, right? The only reason why it would be flying around and not eating something is if it has chicks to feed or a fledgling. So you can see where it go, again, just like with the nesting material, you see where does that bird keep disappearing with that food. And usually the further away you can stand in these situations, the better, so the bird doesn't feel threatened. I definitely learned that with Dick Sisals, that a lot of times I would see a female Dick Sisal carrying food. And if she was close to me, that meant that I was close to the nest. Because normally birds don't want to get that close to you. But if they're really stressed that you're by their nest, then they're not as shy around you as they normally would be. So in that situation, I would back up. I would keep moving away, further away from her until she didn't appear annoyed with me, basically. And that actually leads me to my next one, which is called agitation. And this can be kind of ambiguous, because how do you know when a bird's agitated? But it's something that you kind of get to learn over time. Basically, what does a cardinal sound like normally? Like when it chips, like how frequently does it chip? And then if you're by a nest, it might be chipping a lot more. It might be really close to you, usually a combination of those two. And that was definitely true for dick thistle and many other species of nests they find.
Red-winged blackbird comes to mind.
Yeah, all of a sudden they seem really interested in you. And you're like, this is weird. Normally they like don't care when I'm around, but all of a sudden they have this deep, deep desire to get to know you on a more personal level. Usually that means dive bombing you. Have you guys been dive bombed before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have been too, and other birds do it too. I mean, swallows, even marbled godwits, which are these kind of large shorebirds, sandpipers, and that can be a little scary. And I've heard stories of northern goshawks, which are pretty large hawks, like dive bombing people, sometimes hitting them even. So crazy story about that. I had one of my professors in college, he studied Cooper's hawks in their nests. And he showed us this video. He was checking out, he was trying to gather some data on these chicks in a Cooper's hawk nest. And the female is coming like really close to him, keeps dive bombing. And one of the times that she swoops through, Dr. Rosenfield reaches up and grabs her and is like, oh, I haven't caught her yet. I need to band her and stuff. But just, like, she had gotten that close that he was able to do that, which I think is pretty phenomenal. Like,
wow.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Just like snagging hawks out of the air.
I wish I could say the same about myself, but that's really hard to do from there. But yeah, grass and nests, those are really hard to find because they're on the ground and everywhere the ground, if you've looked like in the grass, it basically all looks the same. So you're like, I went somewhere over here and good luck from there, basically.
I've started birding with a friend here in Maine who is like just getting into birding, and her spark bird was a robin that actually laid a nest like in her window at college. And she was just like, watched the whole process and she named her little bird Chirp. She like showed me like all the pictures she took of Chirp, and she's like, no one is ever as into this as you are. And I was like, yeah, that's probably true.
That's so cute though. Oh,
like, yeah. Yeah. So there's definitely something to the joy of the nest. And I think I even like this time of year, I've started to see like some little baby nests that have been abandoned, like super small ones, right? Like now that all the leaves are falling. And you're like, okay, that's definitely not a squirrel nest. So must have been some bird.
This is a really good time of year to at least kind of get a visual, like, okay, so like bird nest could be kind of in this part of a bush. And a lot of times you'll notice it's like a spot where you've been walking by like all summer, or like this trail that you go, you know, you walk on all the time. It's crazy like how many there are once you see them exposed.
Thank you for all of your tips and knowledge, Alyssa. We want to wrap this up though with, what is your favorite birding moment?
I have a lot of good ones, but I guess the story I'm going to tell tonight highlights the importance of, you know, bonding with other birders and making relationships that can get you on some cool birds sometimes. So it was in northern Minnesota. It was, I believe, February 2013. And my boyfriend at the time and I had driven up there from central Wisconsin where we were going to college. And we went up there because there was a boreal owl eruption. This is a very seldom seen bird, and it's like it's on everyone's wish list, like every birder's wish list. Every once in a while, about once every 5 years, there's an eruption of them. There's like a rodent deficit further north, so a lot of them are kind of starved, and they move south en masse into places like northern Minnesota.
They're so cute.
They're cool, but they're really hard to find because they're these small birds. They usually nest in these really remote boreal forest locations, so they don't get seen a whole lot. So we had gone up here in hopes of seeing one. Now, at the same time, this was also an eruption year for great gray owl, which is also, you know, relatively seldom seen, but they're more regular in Minnesota. And actually, a lot of people around the country will go to northern Minnesota just to see great gray owl. And that day, I think we ended up seeing like 5 great gray owls.
Whoa.
Pretty cool. But in other eruption years, people would tell stories about seeing 40 in a day. It's insane. And these are also super cool birds. And there was one that we were looking at. And I was just about to put my spotting scope away, and a woman had pulled up and said, hey, what are you looking at with the spotting scope? And I said, oh, yeah, there's a great gray owl across the field. Do you want to look through my spotting scope? As a birder, you always kind of want to share the joy with other people. So, and I didn't know if she had her own scope. So she's like, oh, yeah, sure. And so she looked through, she got good looks at it. She's like, oh, my gosh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And by the way, are you looking for boreal owls too? And I was like, yes, that's actually why we're here. That would be a lifer for me. I would love to see one. And she's like, well, why don't we exchange numbers? And if one of us finds one, we can let the other person know. And I was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. Thank you. And so we did. My boyfriend and I went birding for a little bit more. And then we pulled into the town of Two Harbors, Minnesota to eat lunch. And right then I got a phone call from guess who? That lady. And she said, hey, Alyssa, I'm looking at a boreal owl right now in Two Harbors. Are you in Two Harbors? And I was like, are you kidding me? I'm like 2 minutes away. So we went, we finished our lunch quick, and then we drove over, and I got to see my life of boreal owl right there on the spruce tree in the sun, just sitting there sleeping. And it was so cool because no one else told me about boreal owls that day. So had I not, you know, interacted with her, if we had not exchanged phone numbers, I wouldn't have seen one. And that's still to this day, like my best look at a boreal owl. So thank you. And I don't even remember her name, but like she was super kind and I'm really grateful to have bumped into her.
Wow. That's so cool.
So make connections. Yes. Connections are good.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why we're here on this podcast, is from connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I have not been in the birding world that long, but I'm like constantly blown away by the compassion that other birders have, not only for birds, but for other birders. And mm-hmm. just understanding that there's somebody out there who's into the same sort of obscure hobby that you are is just a really reassuring thing. And you just sort of latch onto it.
Yeah. And to an extent, like if they're into birds, you know that they have to be, usually they're a somewhat decent person and that you can probably get along with them.
That's mm-hmm. true.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'd like probably would actively dislike someone who didn't like birds.
Yeah, right. If someone has something against birds, you got to be like, well, I hate.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, that's a really cool story.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. And thanks again for having me. This was really fun. I love talking about birds. So like anytime I get the opportunity, I'm like, hell yeah.
Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, guys. All right, bonne nuit, my bitches.
Thank you so much, Alyssa, for coming on our podcast. I now am going to start adding nesting to my list of hobbies instead of just birding, because that sounds like a great addition to what I already do.
I know, and she's so knowledgeable about all of her areas of research and just like super passionate. It was great.
You're right. When we interacted with her the first time, she really like dubstepped down to us a lot. And then like we bring her on the podcast and we're like, wow, she's a super smart person and she knows 1,000 things. This is awesome. We will make sure to share all the resources that she talked about. We'll make sure to put those in the podcast note to make sure to check those out. And if you have any questions about anything that we discussed today, or you want to reach out with questions we can forward to Alyssa,
or just ask us questions.
Yeah, ask us any questions you want. You know how to get us. We're at hellobirdshit@gmail.com, or send us a DM on the IG @birdshitpodcast.
And keep your eyes to the skies.
Eyes to the skies.
Pizza pies.